it's important for us to take a step back as we prepare ourselves for Purim, and we make sure we know the story of Purim. You know, it happens a lot of times as you go through school, you get a little more sophisticated as you graduate high school and you go through yeshiva. Even when you're in yeshiva and you're learning about the allusions of Megillas Esther's and all the different aspects of the Megillah and the halachas, and even not. In fact, if there's one yontif that you almost forget that it's coming, it's Purim. And you wake up one morning and it's here, and you go through the story and you get it, and you don't get it, and you get the big pieces, and there's a Mordechai, and there's an Esther, and Haman's the bad guy, and Ahasuerus the king was bad and bad and good again. And you don't really see the picture in its entirety, and you lose an appreciation for the story. And so it really does pay before Purim to remind ourselves of the story. And I took this out of a book by Yosef Harav Yosef Deutsch and some other Midrashim, and he compiled it beautifully in his book, I think, Let My Nation Live, and I saw it in some other places as well. And I want to tell over the story, in a story form, based mostly on Midrashim, but in a story context, in order for you to get a sense of the big picture. And that's the purpose of this, is that when you hear it, you sort of spend the time now and you get the context, so that when you're going through the Megillah on Purim or before Purim, or even go through the story of Purim, it's a lot more enjoyable because a lot more understandable. So let's start from the beginning. Not from only the beginning. We'll start from, you know, a nice point of beginning, well before Purim. We'll start from the destruction of the first bias. Okay? The first destruction of the first temple around 586 BCE leads to an exile to Babel, to Babylonia, for about 51 years. Now, who really was the king at the time? It was Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had a descendant named Merodah. Merodah had a descendant named Belshazzar. Now, 2 years after Belshazzar became king, he calculated that it had been 70 years since the end of the destruction of the first bias, and everybody knew that there was a prophecy that said that 70 years later everyone would come back. And so even the Goyim about those days, they were really, you know, the Goyim, they were pretty frum in terms of their Torah knowledge, and they knew that 70 years we'd see is the God of the Jews correct. And what happened was they found, and each and every one of them made a calculation of 70, and as soon as 70 came along and passed, it was a party, because they said, the God of the Jews was wrong, and we can now go around and then not have to worry about losing control to the Jews again. And so in 70 years, when Belshazzar was in his second year of reign, he said 70 years has passed and now the redemption will never come. And so what he did was he made a huge feast and he used the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. Sounds familiar? I'm sure it was the same thing. It seemed like that was the thing at the time. So that night, he made a major feast. He's now the Babylonian king. And at the same night, a coalition of Persians and Medes, Paras Umadai, invaded the empire, killing everybody except for a few people. One of them was a 12-year-old girl named Vashti. Toppled the empire and took control of it and moved the capital to Shushan. Now, over time, king goes to Shushan, money's in Shushan, Jews go to Shushan. All right. Now, let's pause it at this moment and backtrack in time a drop to give you a sense of who was behind this Persian and Medes coalition that just took over control of the world from the Babylonian king Belshazzar. In Persia, there was a king by the name of Astyages. Now, Astyages was a king, and his daughter had one time unfortunately slept with one of the servants, and he found out, and he killed the servant, and he jailed his daughter. But the problem was, his daughter got pregnant. He found out, and when she gave birth, which was to a boy, he took the son in the middle of the night, the boy in the middle of the night, and he left him in the woods. He figured, hey, he couldn't have the heart to kill him, so he'll just let him, you know, fend for himself as an infant in the woods. Miraculously, this boy managed to be found by, I guess, the proper animals, and he grew up with them. When he was older, The king Astyages found out that he was alive, so he sent an army to kill him. Now this man, or this, you know, animal man, I guess, convinced the army that, why would you kill me for? Come fight with me, and we'll take control. And he did. And he marched onto the capital with his new army, and he took control. He became the new king of Persia, and since he didn't have a name, they called him the dog. In Persia, dog is called Koresh, and in English it's Cyrus. And Cyrus was now the new king of Persia, reunited with Darius, who was the king of Medes, and together Cyrus and Darius killed Belshazzar and took over the world. And the deal that had worked out between the two of them was Daryavish and Darius and Koresh, Cyrus, would take turns, and they rotated. When it was Koresh's turn, he authorized that they would begin the building of the Bayis Sheni. He would begin the building of the second temple, which is exactly the way the prophecy predicted in Yirmiyahu. And that's what happened. Now, mid-construction, Koresh, Cyrus, died, and Ahasuerus took his place. Now, we have a little bit of a problem. Prophecy is going well. Construction of the Beis HaMikdash is in full steam. But the Jews don't really want to leave. They're happy in Shushan. They're making good money. Life is fine. No one's killing them. And, you know, slipping back to Israel would be a little bit of a problem. And so, because there was a lack of interest in people, the construction of the Beis HaMikdash wasn't going as smoothly and as quickly as people had hoped. And over time, the Tzedukim had told Ahasuerus that this was really using, the Jews were using the Beis HaMikdash as a way to mount a rebellion. And so Ahasuerus put a stop to the construction. This is where we are right now. This is where the Purim story opens up. Somewhere in that 70-year period after the destruction of the first temple, Babylonia was now taken control by Paras Umadai, Persian Medes, and now Ahasuerus is now the king in charge. Now Ahasuerus does his own calculation and says, "Up, oh, my 70 years is up, and now redemption is never coming, so let me take out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash and use it for my party." And he makes a feast for 180 days. And invites all the nobles from across the kingdom, all 127 provinces. He displays his wealth, he spares no expense, in order for them to all be machshav him, to give him the proper covet, the proper honor as a king. At the end of the meetings, at the end of the parties, he calls over his private advisors and says, "Okay, we have our Jewish problem, right? We have this prophecy, we have these Jews, we gotta get rid of them." And these advisors began to debate how we could effectively eliminate the Jewish problem. And they went one way and went the other way. And it came back and forth that, you know, you never want to mess with their God. You know, you never know. So one of his trusted advisors, a man named Haman, said, wait a second. Why don't we do this? All I know about these Jews is that they tend to really tick off their God. Right, they love him, God loves him, and you know they love God back, but every once in a while they stray, and the only way you can sort of disarm the protective shield around the Jews is by allowing them to sin. And all you have to really is tempt them a drop, and unfortunately many of them sin. So this is what we're going to do. You've been partying for 6 months, why don't you extend your partying for 1 week? We're coming to the time Tishrei. We're coming to the time where the Jews are in their holy season. And now is a time where you can, say, schedule a feast just for the residents of Shushan. Do it right around holy time and let them come and be part of the feast and eat and drink and really disarm their protective shield. And that's what he did. Great idea. Invites the Jews to come on the third day of Tishrei, right after Rosh Hashanah, until the ninth day of Tishrei before Yom Kippur. And the Jews came, and he spared no expense, and they ate, and they drank, and there was food, and there was wine, and there was women, and they indulged. And some people say he even fell on Shabbos, they indulged then too. And Ahasuerus, right in the middle, comes out wearing the big day kahuna, wearing the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, and the Jews said nothing. Okay. At the feast, Ahasuerus gets into a little fight with his advisors over his wife. Now, Vashti, as we said earlier, was a descendant from nobility. She was extremely arrogant. She was the daughter of Belshazzar. She was, you know, as pure as blood as it gets. And now she's the queen of Ahasuerus, the queen of the world. And so if Ahasuerus was having his week-long party, she was going to have her party as well. And she did the same for the Jewish women. She created an environment for the Jewish women to come and to sin. And she had all her own feasts and her own taivas and her own this. And everything was going nice and immoral. Now Ahasuerus is at the feast. And he never really got drunk. And the whole time he kept his cool. But you know, this is the last week. He's with a bunch of Jews. What does he have to lose? So he starts to drink. And all of a sudden, an argument starts to ensue between him and some of his close advisors as to which of your provinces has the prettiest women. You know, a bunch of, you know, brutes sitting around drinking. This is what you talk about. You talk about it now in a bar. You talk about it then in Persia. There's no real difference. So Ahasuerus says, are you kidding me? I've got the prettiest wife in the world. And they say, wait a second, Ahasuerus, that's not fair. I'm like, look how much makeup she has on. She's all pretty. She wears the nicest clothing. She's got 45 hairdressers. She's got the silkiest, you know, cosmetics. So you really can't tell. And he goes, what, are you kidding me? My wife's the prettiest naturally. And I say, yeah, right. And he goes, okay, I'll show you. And he turns, calls over his guard and says, I want you to ask Vashti to come out to everybody without clothes. And the guard almost lost himself when he heard that. He goes, excuse me? He goes, hear what I said. So the guard walks into Vashti and tells her this. And Vashti flips out. Are you kidding me? I'm Vashti. I'm the queen. I'm the daughter of nobility. And he wants me to disgrace myself. And she goes back and she goes forth and she goes back and she goes forth. And she says, you know what? This is embarrassing, but I have to do it. And she's about to walk out, and the Malach of Real comes and puts into her head that she has a tail. And that she has leprosy. And she goes, oh, there's no way I'm going out. She turns to the guard and says, tell my husband, no way. And now you can imagine the anger that Ahasuerus feels sitting around with his boys drinking as the guard comes and says, your wife says no dice. And now Ahasuerus is PO'd. And he is steaming. And around him is his advisors. One of his advisors is a man named Memuchan, which is called Memuchan because he was preparing himself for something, which we don't know what yet because we don't know the end of the story. And people understand that the person to be Haman. What was Haman doing there? Well, when Vashti had disobeyed her husband's will, Ahasuerus turned to his crowd and said, what do I do? Now, Memuchan, Haman, he's always plotting. Now, he's a smart guy, and he's always been trying to get the power for himself. And now he reasons to himself as follows. Right now I'm pretty damn powerful. I am. I'm a powerful guy. But I'm not that powerful. How could I be more powerful if I not only was the trusted advisor of the king, if I was the king's father-in-law? If I, I have a daughter, if I can get Vashti out and my daughter in, then I would be guaranteed gold in the kingdom forever. Not only that, but I have been told by advisors, and in those days they went to astrologers. Astrologers had told Haman that Ahasuerus' wife would lead to his demise. And they were talking about Esther, but he didn't know that. So he says, okay, this is perfect. Here I've got my enemy in the room, on the ropes, with a really drunk, upset husband who's the king of the place. I've got a daughter. This is perfect. So he suggests to Ahasuerus that he kills his wife. But the problem is that Persia is a regular civilized society of some sort. You can't just go around killing people. So the law at the time was that before you executed somebody, you needed proper legal proceedings. So Haman said, wait a second. If I wait this out, there's no way she's getting executed, right? What are the chances that he sobers up, takes her to trial, and they say, because she didn't appear naked, she deserves death? No way. So he convinces Ahasuerus to change the system to allow the king the final word in execution cases, and Ahasuerus says it's a great idea. So he says yes, brings out Vashti, and he executes her. Now, this is amazing the way it works out, because if you notice, Memuchan over here totally set up his own demise. Because not only did he get rid of Vashti, which put in Esther, he then created the ability for a king to say execute without legal proceeding, which is exactly how he got executed at the end of the story. Had he not changed the law to allow the king to say it, Ahasuerus would never have been able to have had him executed when he got mad at him at the end of the story. So there's an amazing quote-unquote coincidence that you'll see throughout the entire story of how Memuchan is prepared, which means preparing, but is preparing his own demise. Okay. Mordechai. Who is Mordechai? A descendant of Binyamin. His mother was a tzaddikess from Shevet Yehuda, which is why he's called Ish Yehudi, even though he's really a Binyamin guy. His real name is Pesachia and Bilshan. But Mordechai is his Persian name from the word Mor Dror, which is Aramaic for Mor Dechi. Mor is a spice used in the Ketores that would abolish evil decrees. And Dror, or Dechi, means to free. So, because Mordechai was the person that would abolish the evil decrees and free the Jews from their oppressors. Now, Mordechai and Haman have a little bit of a history together, as the Medrash teaches us, that they were both generals in Ahasuerus' armies when they were younger. There was a certain city that was rebellious, and Ahasuerus had commanded both Mordechai and Haman to go take the city, circle it with their troops, and lay siege on the city and starve them to death. So Mordechai went down with his troops to half the city, and Haman went down to his troops to half the city, and they laid siege. After about a year, Haman comes knocking on Mordechai's door and says, I got a problem. What's your problem? I got no food left. He says, what do you mean you have no food left? You had enough food for 3 years. And yeah, I know, the guys got some hungry, we had some parties, I don't know, I got no food left, I need food. And Mordechai says, you can't, I can't give you food, I have it perfectly rationed for the next 3 years, I can't give you my food. He says, yeah, but if I don't go back with food, they're going to kill me. He says, okay, I make you a deal. I'll give you food if you will sign to be my slave. He goes, okay, I mean, what choice do I have? Is that or death? And that's what happened. He took off his boot. They signed a contract on the bottom of their boot that Mordechai was going to be the master of Haman. Because he was the master of Haman, he now then controlled all his possessions. So now Mordechai was the general of the entire city. And he laid siege appropriately. And they won. And they came back up to Shushan, to the king Ahasuerus, and Mordechai was hailed as a hero, and Haman was a laughingstock. Now, who is Haman? Now, Haman is from the descendant of Agag, right? Haman ha'Agagi. Who is Agag? When King Shaul, back way when King Shaul was commanded to kill Amalek, he killed everybody except for the queen. And at night, the king Agag snuck in and slept with her, and she bore a son, and she perpetuated Amalek since then. So let's get a sense of what's going on between Haman and Mordechai here. Okay, you have to really appreciate the fight, the rivalry, the tension between Mordechai, the descendant of Binyamin, which was King Shaul, and Haman, the descendant of Agag, which was Amalek. And so the tension between Binyamin and Amalek has existed for generations up until this point. Not to mention that they had their own personal history in which Haman had sold himself to Mordechai, evidencing it by the contract of the shoe. Okay, now we're getting background here. Now, back to the story. Ahasuerus wakes up in the morning and says, whoa, this isn't fun. I got no wife. What am I going to do? So they go, wait a minute, there's 5 billion, you know, eligible bachelorettes that would love to be the queens. He goes, okay, it's a great idea. Why don't we have a contest? So He creates this huge contest in which everyone could sign up for, and girls start coming in from all over the place, except for one type of girl, the Jews. No Jew wants to give his daughter off to be the queen of that king, so they all hid their daughters, and most of them survived, except for the fact that Mordechai happened to have been an elected official. As an elected official, you're constantly in the public eye, and so people knew. Now, wait a second, doesn't Mordechai have a daughter? So they took out Esther, and they brought her to the palace to be part of the contest, and he sees Esther, and he says, "We're done. Contest over. She wins." And Esther becomes the queen of Shushan, the queen of Persia. Mordechai becomes the top advisor, and life continues on. One day, Mordechai is prancing around the courtyard over there, the king's courtyard, because he's the trusted advisor, and he overhears two guys talking. And the reason why he stopped to listen wasn't because necessarily two guys were talking, was because they were talking in a language that no one else spoke about. They're talking in the language of Tarsi, which is a language that at that time was completely forgotten. But Mordechai knew it because he was a member of the Sanhedrin. And as a member of the Sanhedrin, you need to speak all 70 possible languages in order to properly represent the people that came in front of you. So now, Mordechai is walking in and he hears Tarsi. And he listens over and he goes, "Wow, Tarsi." And he gets closer and closer. He starts to listen to people talking in Tarsi. And he goes, "Why are they talking in Tarsi for?" And as he begins to listen, he begins to understand why. There are two people. One person was the king's cupbearer, a man by the name of Bigsan. And one person was the king's gatekeeper, a man by the name of Seresh. Now, Bigsan and Seresh were the king's executives, and they also happened to have been a cousin of Haman. And they got together to complain about how life stunk, and how Esther was now was the queen, and how hard they're working, and how miserable life is, and how, man, it would be great if our cousin Haman was in charge over here. And one says to the other, "Wait a second, why don't we get him in? Well, how do we get him in? Well, why don't we kill the king?" And he goes, "Ooh, now you're talking." He goes, "Here's what we're going to do. Seresh would come in, the gatekeeper would come into the Big Son, who is the wine bearer, would come into his chambers when it was time to prepare a drink. And the king would call in Big Son to prepare a drink, and he would walk out and say, "What would you like, my sire?" And he'd say, "I want you to bring me, you know, a vodka Collins." So he'd go back in to prepare the Collins, but at the same time, Seresh was already mixing the poison. So this way it'd be quick. No one knew you're planning out poison. You'd come in, I'd pop a little poison in, you bring it to the king dies, Haman takes over, we win. Great idea. Problem. Mordechai overheard. Mordechai tells Esther. Esther tells Ahasuerus. Put in Mordechai's name. Ahasuerus says, "Sure, I'm in. I'll play cool." That night comes. He calls in Bigsan. "Can I have a drink?" "Sure, no problem." He walks back. Seresh is mixing the poison. He brings him out. He hands it to the guard. The guard takes a sip and dies. He takes the two jokers over here, Bigsan and Seresh, and kills them both. That night he writes down in his book that, "Oh yeah, by the way, Mordechai saved my life." Life goes on. About 5 years pass. And sure, it's like about 10 seconds when you think this happens the next day. Not in reality. 5 years pass. And now Haman is rising through the ranks like wildfire. He becomes the second in command of the entire emperor. And as a smart man, what he does is he says, "Okay, here's what we're going to have to do now that I'm second in command. Number one, everyone's going to have to bow to me. Now I got to like pick up my ego a drop. So everyone's going to bow to me." And what he would do is, because he was just so Haman-like, he would wear idols in his outfits, on his clothes, so that when a Jew would bow to Haman, which was a legislated command, they'd be bowing to an idol, and they'd be over on an Isser. And so this way he'd be able to, you know, double get the Jews. And everyone did it except for Mordechai. Why in the heck would Mordechai bow to his own slave? And every time he passed by Mordechai and he didn't bow, it just got him more and more angry. Secondly, what he did, which was a brilliant move by him, was that he created a law that nobody was able to see the king without his permission. Unless that person was invited, which he usually coordinated, that person never saw the king, so it allowed the king to sit in his throne And he, Haman, would delegate and designate who would walk into the king, and so this way he was able to keep complete control. Great. Life is great for Haman except for one thing, Mordechai. And one day, he looks at Mordechai, and the guy doesn't bow, and he says, enough is enough. I am not only going to kill you, I'm going to kill all your dirty little people. And he utters the same words that unfortunately has been uttered from generation to generation, let's kill the Jews. What does he do? Being a superstitious man himself, he decides he's going to draw a lottery. Now this is happening in Nisan. Okay, this is another big thing that I never really got, was that I always thought that this all happened during Adar. It didn't. It happened in Nisan. On the 13th day of Nisan, Haman takes two boxes, one for the days and one for the months. And he puts his hand in at the same time, and he pulls out two lottos, two tickets. One says Adar, and one says 13. He says, perfect. 11 months from now, that'll be the day that's destined for the Jews for destruction. Probably like, you know, laugh like that, like cynical laugh. And he goes to Achashverosh, and he walks into the kingdom, and he goes, you guys have a problem. Achashverosh says, what's my problem? He goes, the problem we've been speaking about for a long time. The problem of a bunch of people that have no one to marry your daughters, don't want to eat your food, don't want to deal with you, and between me and you are the cancer in your society. So Achashverosh goes to Jews, he goes, yep. So Achashverosh goes, we spoke about these guys already. Don't you remember? We can't mess with them because they have a god that'll kill us. And he goes, no. Easy there, Mr. Your Honor. He says, first of all, their god's getting old. I haven't seen any big miracles in a long time. He goes, and secondly, the way that God works is that he really only blames the people that do the work. He goes, so I had a idea for you. Why don't I buy off all the Jews, and now they're not your property anymore. They're not your problem. I'll do what I gotta do. You're untouched. It's not your problem. You don't get hurt by their god. And let me incur his wrath. Achashverosh calls over some of his trusted advisors. What do you think? And they look back and forth. They go, you know what, Taka? It's not a bad idea. You're not gonna be involved. They're not your possessions anymore. It works. So Achashverosh turns around to Haman and says, you know what? You got yourself a deal. He takes off his ring, his signet ring, that is used to sign documents, and hands it to Haman and says, do me a favor, take care of it, and let me know when it's over. That moment was the scariest moment probably in Jewish history. And as Chazal say, the taking off the ring caused more tshuva than 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses. Because the minute that people found out what happened, that was it. Haman took the ring, walked into the next room, signed the letter saying that on the 13th of Adar, everybody is obligated to leave their homes and kill Jews. He signed it with his ring, sealed the letter, sent out the horses to get it delivered. Now you can imagine what has happened in Shushan. The place is up in arms. You've got your pro-Jew guys, the Jews, and I guess some liberals at the time, that were sitting there picketing and arguing and fighting. I can't believe this is happening. And they go into the king's courtyard, and they're like, what are you doing to us? And you got the anti-Semites that are saying, it's about time. 13th of Adar, I'm not waiting for 13th. I'm going to start beating up the Jews now. And the pogrom started, and everything started going crazy. Now, I don't think Haman or Achashverosh thought that it would happen like this. And so Haman was a little nervous that Achashverosh would look outside his window, see the country in turmoil, and say, whoa, Haman, give me back my ring. Okay, you went too far. Okay, bad move. So what he did was he walked into the palace, and he walked upstairs to Achashverosh's office, to his throne, and he said, I think me and you need to have dinner. And Achashverosh says, you know what? I'm actually hungry. Was perfect. And he calls in the royal caterers, and he calls in the royal orchestra. And he tells the orchestra, play it loud, boys, play it loud. And as the music is drowning out the sounds of outside, everybody is watching Haman sit down to eat with Achashverosh. And as they watched Haman and Achashverosh break the bread and have the Suda, they said it was over. This is it. This deal, the deal is signed. It's over. What's happening right now in Shemayim? In Shemayim, the Yetzer Hara, the Sitra Achra, is coming up to the Kodesh Baruch Hu and saying, listen, it's time. These guys haven't been so good. You know, you take them out of Mitzrayim, you hook them up like crazy, you make them chosen, you walk them into Israel, you hand them your house. I mean, I don't know what more you want from them. You know, you tell them in 70 years you're going to build the house. Right, you're going to build a Beis HaMikdash again. They get this beautiful king. Koresh is giving them back the Beis HaMikdash. And they don't even want to go. They're in Shushan. Achashverosh calls for a party. They sin. They sin. It's been 5 years. They're sinning like crazy. Yitzhar says it's time. And he hands HaKadosh Baruch Hu a letter to annihilate the Jews. The decree. And the Kodesh Baruch Hu looks at the decree and he signs it. And that's it. It's over. The Jews are now spiritually and physically destined for destruction. What's happening on earth? Mordechai is now in tears. He understands what's happening in Shemayim. He understands what's happening on the earth. And so he tears his clothes. He wears sackcloth. And he walks around and he tries to amass the people to do tshuva. He sends Esther a message. Please, please do what you can to get the decree rescinded. Now, Esther's got the problem. Why? Because as we said earlier, Haman, when he became the number two in command, he made a law that you can't walk into the king's palace, the king's throne room, uninvited. And if you do, it's automatic death. So now Esther couldn't go in. So Esther tells Mordechai, chill out, man. What can I do? It's over. And then Mordechai utters the ultimate words, Im hacharesh tacharishi. If you stay quiet now, the Jews will be saved, but you and your house will go down. And who knows, in Ka'es Kazos, Yigiel Malchus. Who knows that if you didn't become destined for royalty, not for this moment. And Esther hears it, she accepts it, and she says, okay. Go, Lech Knosis Kol Yehudim, go get the Jews and start to fast for me. And that's what he did. He collected the Jews and they fasted and davened for 3 days. Which ended up being, and there's a machlokes as to when it was, the Tanis Esther, the original Tanis Esther, which was between the 13th and the 15th, or the 14th and the 16th of Nisan. And so that year the Jews didn't have a Pesach Seder. The third day, she gets dressed. She has her servants walk her into the king, and she gets closer and closer to the inner chamber. And as she gets closer to the chamber, the gods realize that what is she doing? She's walking into the chamber uninvited, and they go to take her. And the minute they're about to apprehend her, the door opens, and Achashverosh looks at her, and everything stops. If Achashverosh would acknowledge her existence, it should be okay. If he turns his head, that means he leaves her to the lions. And Achashverosh turns his head. And at that moment, the guards come to take her. And they grab her. And the Malach Gavriel comes down and slaps Achashverosh's face. So he turns back at Esther. And he sees Esther being apprehended by these guards. And his heart breaks. And he says, stop. And everything stops. And he extends out his stick, his cane, to Esther. Now the staff from which he extended obviously wasn't far enough, but a miracle happened, and the staff extended all the way through the room, all the way up to Esther, and Esther held on to the staff and walked all the way back into the inner chamber. And she comes to the inner chamber, and Ahasuerus says to her, "What do you need? What do you want?" And she says, "She wanted to invite you to a feast. I wanted to invite you to dinner. That's it." He goes, "Dinner?" He goes, "Yeah, she wanted to invite you to dinner." He goes, "Okay, fine, I'm coming. What time?" He goes, "I don't know, 7:30. He goes, "Oh yeah, by the way, can you bring Haman with you?" And he pauses and goes, "Okay, sure." Already beginning to be curious as to why Haman would be invited. So time comes, Ahasuerus and Haman show up, and Esther's sitting there already prepared. And she's catering and serving for Haman and Ahasuerus, because it's still on her third day, she's still can't eat, she's still fasting. And she's being especially nice to Haman. And Ahasuerus is getting a little nervous. "What's going on with you guys? What are you guys, what's cooking over here? Why are you so nice to Haman for? And why are we having this meal for?" And she says, "I just wanted to bring you to a meal to ask you for a favor." She says, "Yes, what would you like?" He goes, "I'd like for you guys to have a meal with me again tomorrow." And he goes, "Okay, sure." He goes, "Okay, that's it, thank you." And the meal ends, and Esther achieves her goals. First, she totally makes Ahasuerus curious. She puzzles him. Why in the world would Esther have a feast to invite us to a feast? And why in the world would he invite Ahasuerus? And number two, Esther turns Haman into someone that's overconfident. She hands Haman the gift of arrogance, and Haman takes it willingly. So now both parties walk away exactly where Esther wanted them. Ahasuerus walks away curious and bewildered and a little on guard, and Haman walks away completely happy and completely off guard. The night ends, and Haman goes home. And he says, "You know what? I'm feeling lucky. I have the king in my back pocket, and the queen always is a little weird to me. I don't know where she's from, some weird nationality. She's all connected to Mordechai. I don't know. She's always, you know, a strange cookie, but you know what? She must like me." So he calls his closest friends, all 365 friends. He calls into his house and says, "All right, the time has come. I've got my hand. It's time to play. It's time for me to move to kill my arch nemesis, to kill Mordechai." So they start giving suggestions. "Why don't you throw him in the fire? Why don't you throw him in the den? Why don't you throw him, cut his head off?" And Mordechai, being the good old-fashioned anti-Semite, he goes, "No, that won't work. Because every one of the things you suggested, some Jew was saved already. You know, Avram was saved from the fire, and you had Daniel in the lion's den, and you had, that won't work, and that won't work, and that won't work." He's like, "I need a way to kill Mordechai that God has never saved the Jews from." And the one guy raises his hand and goes, "Well, I have an idea. Why don't you hang him?" He goes, "Ooh, I like that." And he goes, "Even better." He goes, "Why don't I hang him with cedar wood, erez? Because a Jew is compared to every wood except for cedar. Because cedar wood is so rigid that it doesn't shake. And a Jew can't be that rigid. And so this is the perfect idea. Why don't I hang him on cedar wood?" "Beautiful. Bravo." And Haman says, "And I got one better. My house is built on the cedar beam that was used in Noah's ark. Why don't I just destroy half my house, rip up the beam? It's perfect. It's 50 feet. I'll rip it up, stand in my backyard, and build gallows from that beam." Wonderful. Late at night, he walks back in the palace. He rounds up all the royal carpenters. He brings over all the candle holders. And he goes, has them all go to work. And he's loving it. And they're building and they're building and they're building. Long, big, tall gallows with the cedar beam. And he goes, "You know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build the gallows. I'm going to wake up early in the morning before Esther wakes up. This way I don't get any, you know, I don't want to jinx anything. And I'll walk into Ahasuerus and say, 'Listen, Ahasuerus, we both know I'm in. Listen, Mordechai is the guy out. He's the cancer that we spoke about. I know we're supposed to wait for 13 months to kill all the Jews, but Mordechai's got to go now. That's what I'm going to do. Perfect. So Haman is all excited. He can't sleep. He's walking around the gallows. He's watching construction. He's passing out lemonade. He's passing out hot chocolate. He's just so pumped. And he starts to walk around the neighborhood. Now, at the same time, what's happening? Mordechai is doing tshuva. But Mordechai knows the tricks. So how is he doing his tshuva? He's learning in cheder with 100 of little kids. And he's sitting there with the kids and he's davening with them and he's learning with them, and all of a sudden Haman hears the sounds of Hebrew coming in from the room, and he opens the door and he sees Mordechai sitting with hundreds of little kids. And he says, this is crazy. So he takes them and he arrests them all. And he shackles them and he binds them. And he takes them all to jail. And the mothers find out that their little kids are in jail, so they run to their children, and they give them food, and they bring them water, and they hug them, and they say, don't worry, and the kids won't take the food, and the kids won't take the water, and the kids daven, and they cry, and they cry, and they cry, and Mordechai is egging them on, and they're crying, and they're saying Tehillim, and all of a sudden their tears go up, and up, and up, and up, until it breaks open the heaven gates. Breaks open, Shari Dima, Lo Nimaluch, Shari Dima, never ever sealed. And the tears of the children break open the gates, and walk, the tears, Kivyacha, as if it could, walk, take the decree, and Hashem sees his children crying, and he takes a decree in which he signed for the destruction of Klal Yisrael, and he rips it. Now, a lot going on tonight. And at that moment, the Kodesh Baruch Hu ripped the decree. A Malach slaps Achashverosh across the face. And Achashverosh, in the middle of the night, he's all bewildered. And he wakes up. He's like, what's going on around here? And he gets slapped again. And he tries to go back to sleep. And he's slapped again. He goes, the world's turning upside down. You're not sleeping, buddy. He's getting knocked around. He's getting all beaten up by some little Malach. And he's going back and forth and tossing and turning. And he can't fall asleep. So he wakes up. And he yawns and he gets out of bed and he goes, okay, what am I going to do? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, gosh. I know what I'll do. Why don't I get that book that I always like, the book about Zichronos, my diary. Craig got my diary. Get me a reader. And start reading me stuff, great things that I did. And that night, the reader opens up the book and it automatically, coincidentally, opens up to the page where Mordechai saved his life. And he starts to remember, yeah, I remember, Big Son and Seresh, yeah, those guys, they tried to kill me. And Mordechai overheard. And Mordechai tried to save my life. Huh. Look at that. And then it hits him. I never repaid Mordechai. I never once said thank you or gave him any honor or gift for saving my life. Maybe that's why Esther wants to have the Suda. Maybe that's her favor she wants to ask. Maybe she wants a me and Haman in the room to start to ask for an idea as to how to repay Mordechai. I know they're close. Oh, amazing. I got it. I figured it out. I'm so smart. This is what I'm going to do. I am going to not only pay him back, but I'm going to pay him back before she even gets up tomorrow morning. This way, by the time she gets up, Esther took care of it. So that's what he does. He's up early in the morning, thinking about a way how to repay him, and guess who? He's walking up through the courtyard, Haman, who's walking in early to get Achashverosh to have him kill Mordechai. So he sees Haman and he goes, Haman, what would you do for somebody the king wants to show honor? The ultimate riddle. And Haman says, whoa, that's a loaded question. He's like, okay, let me think this through for a second. On the one hand, I mean, who else could it be but me? Because, like, I mean, who else would the king like but me? On the other hand, what happens if it's not me? If it's not me, I'm not taking a chance. Oh, no. At losing any power or signet ring or house or money. He's like, okay, this is what I'm going to have to do. We're going to have to come up with something that has a lot of honor, but no substance. Perfect. He says, I know what you're going to do. Dress him in royal clothes, head to toe. Take the king's best horses and stick them on it. make sure that everyone could bow to him at the penalty of death, and have somebody stand in front of the horses and say, this is what will happen to a man in which the king wants to honor. Ahasuerus loves it. Starts to get a little suspicious over how much fun Haman's having with this whole pretend to be a king thing, but puts it in the back of his mind and loves the idea. And as Haman's ready to say, okay, listen, you know, I'm a size 34D, he goes, this is what I need you to do. I need you to go get Mordechai. Mordechai. And do this whole thing to him. And you can imagine Haman's face. And he's like, well, you know, I didn't really mean that. I mean, I really think you should just give him any horse. So just say thank you. Totally just buy him some flowers or candy basket. It's fine. And Ahasuerus says, no. This is the deal. This is your idea. Do it. Now, Haman's walking outside the palace, and Hester finds out what this is about. Ahasuerus tells her, look what I did for you. Mordechai, I remember. Now, Haman's on his way to give Mordechai this honor. And Esther goes out and calls a national holiday, meaning everyone has to close their stores and show up to the town center so when Mordechai drives his horse, everyone can give him the proper honor. So, Haman goes down to look for Mordechai. And what does he see? Mordechai sitting there, sackcloth, unshaven, fasting, davening, waiting for a redemption. Mordechai, Haman walks in, and Mordechai is davening, nowhere to go. And Haman sits there, and he waits. Mordechai doesn't turn around, and Haman's waiting. And finally, Mordechai turns and goes, "Can I help you?" And he goes, "Yeah. I sort of have to take you to do the following things." And he tells him exactly what he needs to take him to do, in terms of getting him, you know, on a horse and the best clothes. Mordechai says, well, I can't do that. He goes, why? He goes, because look at the way I look. I haven't cut my hair. I haven't shaved. I haven't taken a bath. I look like a mess. So he goes, fine. So he goes, let's go get you a bath. So he goes to the bath attendant, but everything's closed. Esther declared a national holiday. So Haman begrudgingly takes out his scissors and starts to cut Mordechai's hair. And then he starts to bathe him and clean him and totally work over him. Now he takes him to the king's palace, puts on his clothes, walks up to the horse, and Mordechai says, and I can't get on the horse, it's too big. So Haman gets down, Mordechai steps on his back, and you can imagine what Haman is going through right now. And Haman has to take him in front of the thing. Haman takes him on the horse and walks him through the streets and says, this is what will happen to a man in which the king attempts to repay. And you can only imagine the humiliation that Haman is going through at this moment. His arch nemesis is being pranced around like the king's man, and he is like the slave walking through. And then just when things couldn't get any worse, Haman's daughter looks outside her window, and he sees a man walking the horse, Haman, who's embarrassed or has his head down, and sees a man on the horse, Mordechai, who's embarrassed to get everyone look at him, has his head down, and goes, oh man, this is amazing. My father's being honored, and that guy Mordechai is probably walking him around. So she takes a bucket of hot excrement and stands on her roof, and as the thing passes by, she times it perfectly and drops the bucket on her father's head, not realizing that it was her father. And then Haman turns up to look to see who in the world would kick him while he's down, and sees it's nothing but his daughter. And their eyes lock, and she realizes what she did. She jumps off the roof and commits suicide. The parade is over. Haman's humiliated. He goes home, and in his house is the 365 of his best friends. And they say, you know what? We changed our mind. You can't do it. You just got rocked. You got poured hot excrement over your head in front of everybody. You walked around Mordechai in the entire world. There's no way in heck you're going to pull this off. In fact, I don't even think there's a way you can stay around after what you went through. So they said, this is what we think you should do. Leave Shushan. Go to a different province. you're a powerful guy, you got tons of money, stick it out for a few months, let this whole thing blow over, and you come back with a small little army, and you can dominate, mount the rebellion. Haman says, you know what, it's not really a bad idea, maybe you're right. And as Haman's about to agree, in come the royal guards. Can I help you? Haman, your honor, you're late. For what? You were supposed to be at a meal with the king and queen. Don't you remember you agreed to it yesterday? At that moment, Haman says, okay, no problem. Let me go and change. I got some stuff on me I want to clean off, and I'll be right with you. He goes, no, no, no. You come with me right now. And they drag Haman out, and they drag him into the palace, and he comes into the room, and already the meal has begun between the king and the queen. You can imagine the way he looks and the way he smells. And he sits down, and they continue their suda. They continue their meal. And everything is going great. And the king's like sniffing a little bit, why Haman smells that way. And Esther's being so nice. And Achashverosh is being so nice. And Esther starts to talk about her people. And she says, you know, Achashverosh, I never really told you about my people. My people are very loyal to you. And my people have never once tried to do anything but to serve you loyally. But there's this guy that I want you to know about. And this guy has been trying to usurp the throne since he started becoming close to you. And as she's talking, Achashverosh begins to get it. And she goes, you know, this guy has been trying, he got Vashti killed, and he's been trying to pin all the problems on my people, but at the end of the day, he's just trying to position himself to become the king. And Achashverosh begins to look across the table and realize, you know what? Esther's right. And at that moment, Esther says, this guy has been out to get your throne. And Achashverosh says, who is this guy? And Esther looks across the table and looks down, points down the strongest man in the empire and says, Haman. And at that moment, Achashverosh was furious. And he hit him. He's right. Haman was the one that got me get rid of Vashti. And Haman was the one that got no one to talk to me because they had to go through him. And Haman was the one that got me to kill the Jews. And Haman went, Haman, and Haman, and Haman, and Haman. And he realizes, he goes, oh my God, Haman is playing me. So he goes outside to his garden to relax a little bit because, you know, the last time that he got all pissed off at somebody, what happened? He killed her. He killed his wife. And he's in his garden and he starts to relax and he sees three people. Three of Haman's children. They're really malachim, but they look like Haman's children. And they're uprooting his garden. He goes, what are you doing? He said, we're uprooting the king's garden. He goes, why? He goes, because our father told us to do so. And that was it. And Achashverosh says, this is it. And he comes storming back in. And at the same time, Haman is standing on his knees, begging Esther, please, don't say these things. Forgive me. I'm sorry. And he was pushed by a malach, and so now he was on top of Esther. And Haman walks into the room, and Haman is literally on top of Esther. And he says, what, are you kidding me? In front of my eyes? You don't only want my kingdom, but you want my wife? That's too much. And now it's quiet. No one knows what to do. And in steps in the man that no one knows who he is, but we all love him, named Charvona. But Gam Charvona Zocher Latov, as the song says. And Charvona, some people say he was Eliyahu Navi, some people say he was Haman's quote-unquote fake friend, whoever it was, he says, you know that Haman built gallows to hang Mordechai. Why don't we use them for Haman? And Achashverosh says, good idea. And Haman gets whisked off into the gallows, and now that Achashverosh, the law allows him to do so, he does. And Haman gets hung, and Haman's dead. Now, that's when you say, yay, we win. Haman loses. Jews live happily ever after. That's not what happens. Because although Haman's death was really, really good, the decree was still outstanding. And Esther began to plead with Achashverosh to rescind the decree that on the 13th of Adar, the Jews should get killed. And finally, after pleading and pleading and pleading, he can't repeal the decree. But he does is he sends out another decree that allows the Jews to defend themselves. And so this is where we are. Nisan, 13 months away from a showdown that nobody knows about, because we're talking about, you know, a long time ago before the phones. And all people know in towns is that there's a decree that comes from Achashverosh, kill the Jews, and then there's a subsequent decree that comes in, defend yourself. And the Jews begin to prepare for war. We forget this part when we're reading the Megillah. We think it's over when the minute you hear like the 10 sons and the quick voice, it's over. Now you have to like Mishloach Manos part in Shoshana Yaakov. Oh no. This is where it gets good. 9 months later, 13th of Adar, the morning of, and the Jews wake up and nobody shows up except for one people, Amalek. And the Jews begin to go to war and they start to battle, and like they did the first time, they start to beat Amalek. Now in Shushan, it happened to have been a high population of Amalek, and so the war went on for an extra day. And as soon as the war was done, Mordechai and Esther enacted a day of feasting and celebration for the day after the fighting. And so since in the old the provinces there were a few Amalek, so they took them on the 13th of Adar to fight, and on the 14th of Adar they feasted. But on Shushan, it took 2 days. The 13th and the 14th to fight, so they feasted on the 15th. That's why it was called Shushan Purim, the day after everyone else. And the law is that the city that had the walls at the time of Yoshua, that's considered time of Shushan Purim. Why? Because at the time Yerushalayim didn't have all its walls, but they didn't want to embarrass Yerushalayim. And that's what it's all about. Purim ends off at a time in which the Jews are giving Shalach Manus, and the Jews are fostering relationships between themselves and between them and Hashem. V'kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim, the Jews were able to look through this natural win, this natural salvation, and not say, whew, we got lucky, but they saw Hashem through it. And that was the beauty in the Galus of Purim, that the Jews were able to look at this natural win, this natural survival, and say, this is because of Hashem. Kimlu v'kiblu ha'yehudim, they accepted what they had already accepted from before, their commitment to Hashem, and they renewed their commitment to Hashem, and they renewed their desire to get close to Hashem, and that was the ultimate win of Purim, and that was the ultimate story of Purim.